supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
They're just beginning to figure out how big the problem is locally and pinpoint exactly what's causing it. From New Jersey, I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
It's 81 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia, going up to a high of 87 today with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in the question of the week, we'll examine dodder, a very deadly to plants parasitic vine that looks like silly string. We're also going to warn people who have a lawn care service about a new herbicide that turns out to be killing trees around the country. But we're also going to take lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Karen. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, in Berks County.
Verve, Kutztown now.
Yeah.
Ring baloney once, ring baloney twice. Kutztown, Kutztown, ain't that nice now?
You're from Berks County, too, I think, or live there.
I have friends who went to the university.
Okay.
All right, what can we do for Karen out by Kutztown?
Last summer, I put in a stone walkway and a little pond, and between the stones and in areas around the pond and the stones, I've planted moss. But the moss doesn't compete with weeds, and so weeds come up in the moss, and it's very tedious to pull them all. So, of course, I don't want to use anything inorganic, especially near the pond where there are toads and fish and frogs. So I wonder, is there anything organic that I can use that will kill weeds without killing the moss?
Okay, so the basics of moss, it needs three things. It needs shade and it needs moisture. Is it getting both of those?
It's getting partial shade. The moss that I planted has volunteered and come up in places that get a fair amount of sun on the patio right next to this pond and walkway.
Did you buy your moss commercially?
No, I just got a spatula and sort of
moved it from one place to another.
Yeah, right. Okay. Nearby, though, the same condition.
Okay. What's the chance that you didn't prepare the soil well enough and these weed seeds are simply germinating underneath the moss?
100% chance.
Oh, okay. One thing you might want to do is you might want to start over and do the stale seed bed technique, which is what I would have advised you to do. How big an area? I mean, because you got two options. One, you can just, you can move the moss. You can just put it on a rock or something, you know, put it in a holding pattern. And then what you would do, you could either take out what's in between these pavers and fill it with soil-free mix, and everybody goes home early. You could even just fill it up with peat moss. The
the
moss would love that.
I removed the soil to a fair depth.
Okay.
And then put screening in.
Yeah.
But I did sprinkle some soil between the rocks, and that might be where the seeds came from.
Your garden soil.
Yes.
Yeah, that was your mistake.
Yeah.
If you were to have asked me how to do this perfectly, I would have said to excavate down a couple of inches, maybe then water the area while it's still sunken, let the weeds come up, and then torch those or pull those.
Yeah.
Then I would have covered that with like a couple inches of just milled peat moss and spread the moss itself on top of that. It would have loved that acidity.
Yeah, that would have been great, and I would have gotten preemptively rid of the weeds.
And don't forget, you can always play around and rejuvenate small areas at a time and do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can, like I said, you can even save the moss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's real easy to move this stuff around.
Right, yeah.
Have you done anything to acidify the soil for the moss?
No, I haven't.
Sprinkling peat moss is going to be helpful. It's going to lower the acidity. You know, get one of those little bricks of peat moss, milled peat moss. They cost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And try dusting it around And what you want to do is you want to make the soil so acidic the weeds can't survive, but the moss will thrive.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And then if that's not working in some areas or it's working too slowly, just dig up those pavers, replace the soil with pure peat moss, put the moss back on top, and I really don't think you'll have any weed incursions after that.
Well, I don't know if I can just dig up those pavers. That was hard enough to do the first time, but maybe working in between.
That's all I mean.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
scrape it all out. No, I don't want you to be lifting pavers.
Yeah, my masonry career is over. That's the last thing I'm putting in.
Hard work is for chumps. You know, just just get the right size screwdriver or something and a row down there and, you know, scrape everything out.
Yeah.
Fill it with peat moss, and then that would be the perfect substrate for...
Okay. And what about corn gluten that you use to stop the seeds from germinating, the weed seeds?
Yes, but that will only stop new seeds from germinating.
Uh-huh.
It won't do anything to existing weeds.
Right, I understand that. I mean, if I'm pulling out all the existing weeds and I get them all and I prevent them from reseeding and I use the corn gluten meal, then I'd prevent more and more weeds from coming, right?
You could try it. It's high nitrogen and it might stunt the growth of the moss, though. I think the answer is peat moss. You might get away with just dusting it around until the weeds don't like it there anymore.
Yeah.
Or like I say, just replant small areas at a time.
Right.
And just make sure the moss goes right on top of peat moss.
Thank you very, very much. It was a great pleasure finally talking to you after listening for so many years.
Well, thank you, and we hope you continue to listen.
We will, and we're members.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for that phone call.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, take care, Karen.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
I'm doing fine today. How are you?
I am well, thank you. And where is Jay doing good?
I'm from Kingsport, Tennessee, which is the northeast corner of Tennessee.
Down in the Tri-Cities area?
Yes.
What can we do for Jay in the Tri-Cities area?
Well, I've been growing some tomato plants on my deck in pots, and this year, for the first time, I'm having a family of raccoons visit, and they are continually uprooting the tomato plants and digging in the earth of the pots. They're not eating the tomatoes or the plants or the roots, but they're just digging, and I don't know what they're digging for.
Now, you've actually seen the raccoons doing this.
Yes.
Because this sounds much more like squirrel behavior.
Oh.
Squirrels are notorious for this. I have never heard of raccoons digging in the soil of a pot. There's nothing in there that would interest them. Whereby squirrels, in addition to being evil servants of Satan, have a habit of collecting things like nuts from the woods, especially black walnuts. And then they find some nice soil where you're growing some stupid plant. So the squirrel, being a nice servant of Satan, will uproot your plant and put the black walnut nut down into there so that they can start turning the world into the black walnut forest that is their goal.
Wow.
So are you sure it's raccoons and not squirrels?
Well, I'm not, I guess. I've seen the raccoons all over the deck.
Right.
But I've never seen a squirrel.
But you've not seen
in the pots, but.
You've not seen the raccoons in the pots, have you?
No, I guess not.
Yeah. This is very common. It works with insects, it works with animals. We blame the thing that we can see. Now, in some cases, it almost doesn't matter because the end result is going to be the same. But the raccoons are there waiting for your tomatoes to ripen up. You do know this, Jay. They're going to eat every tomato.
Oh.
Do you have your tomatoes in cages for support?
No, but...
You're going to have to.
I probably should do that.
Yes. The simplest thing for you to do is go out and get a nice roll of animal fencing, rabbit wire, turkey wire, something that's tall enough either to go into the sides of the container or just slide down the container itself, and make sure you have enough wire and a pair of tin snips to make a roof for the container. They won't be able to get at the soil in the pots. They won't be able to get at the fruits. I want you to make sure that you have, like, some twist ties holding it on or something that will easily allow you to reach in and get the fruits. But, you know, raccoons are not safe to have hanging around a house being seen all the time. They are cute little bags of rabies. So you should really try to discourage these raccoons. Make sure all your trash is in sealed metal containers. Don't feed any animals outside. Don't have any garbage in a compost pile. You do not want the raccoons to get used to coming close to your house. They are not only nuisances, they are really dangerous. That's why so many people where you are have dogs.
Yeah, well, that could be an option. We have a beagle. They put her on the deck.
Anything that is known, I'm serious, dogs, motion-activated lights and radio, motion-activated sprinkler, cage your fruit. Be very cautious about not feeding them in any way. Leave nothing outside your house that they could use for food, and hopefully they'll get tired of hanging around and go pester somebody else.
Thank you, Mike. Thank
All right.
you very much.
Well, I think we saved your tomatoes and maybe saved a little bit more. So you got
I think
some.
So. It sounds like it.
You got some work to do, Jay. Get cracking.
Thanks. Love your show.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Well,
it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of our overplanted listeners that food banks around the country would love to receive donations of your extra homegrown goodies to help feed the hungry. You can find the food bank nearest you by visiting the Feeding America website or by typing the words food bank in your location into your favorite internet search engine. But don't go tallying up your tomato tender just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, what to do if daughter comes a-calling, and a tragic story about a new lawn herbicide killing off trees. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
WHYY-FM now reaches the Jersey Shore. Don't leave your favorite public media provider behind. Tune in to WHYY-FM at 89.7 in Atlantic City. WHYY-FM, member-supported public media for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will examine the mysterious parasitic plant known by many names, the most common of which is dodder. We'll also be taking lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Dr. Bert Craig, an associate professor of horticulture and forestry and an extension specialist with Michigan State University, who has been fielding calls from pretty much all over the nation about tree deaths that are linked to a new lawn herbicide. Dr. Craig, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Okay, good to be here.
Thank you for joining us today, sir. Now, let's bring everybody up to speed. I think it was last fall the EPA approved a new lawn herbicide for professional use only. That was felt to be much safer and more effective than the lawn herbicides on the market previously. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, that's right. This product, Imprelis, that we're talking about was approved. It has, we say, a low mammalian toxicity. That is, in the testing, it's shown that it's very safe in terms of its effects on, you know, humans and other mammals. So that's a good thing. And certainly compared to some of the products that are out there. Also, because of its mode of action. It's what we call a synthetic auxin. It mimics some of the natural hormones that are present in plants. Because of this action, the fact that it has some active root uptake, it was more effective against some of the more difficult to control weeds that we commonly find in our lawns, and so that was sort of the marketing point of this product.
Yeah, I know some of the landscapers who are involved, they're very upset because people are still trying to figure out the liability on these trees and how to determine exactly which ones did die from the herbicide. But they loved it because apparently it worked on wild violets, which are our regular lawn care expert, Dr. Nick Christians of Iowa State University, says is the most herbicide-resistant lawn plant out there.
Yeah, it's tough. Around here we have ground ivy. There are several of these things that, if you apply, the common thing you might use as a homeowner might be something like a Weed Be Gone, something like that. And, often they'll cause some of these weeds to kind of curl up and maybe look a little sick for a while, but over time they'll kind of come back on you. So that was, again, the promise of Imprelis. And we're still a lot to learn. It's early in this. The product really has only been widely used since earlier this spring, so there's probably lots more questions than answers, I suspect, at this juncture.
Now, let's make clear that the product name is Imprelis, I-M-P-R-E-L-I-S. It's manufactured by DuPont, and it has not been made available to homeowners. It is just for use by professionals who probably, as you say, used it really for the first time this spring. And how quickly after that was it noticed that certain susceptible trees were... and I'll let you describe how rapid the decline was.
Yeah, when you talk to some of these applicators, probably within about 3 weeks or so, they began to see, some issues. We actually had some pictures that came in here. We didn't know really what was going on. Probably in early June that we saw some initial reports that something was going on. When you start to see some of the symptoms, twisting of new growth, browning of foliage, that are often characteristic of this type of herbicide injury. It was fairly specific in terms of most of the plants that we're seeing affected primarily were some of our faster-growing conifers, so things like Norway spruce and eastern white pine, blue spruce to a certain extent, were the ones that really seemed to be most commonly impacted.
And it's my understanding that the trees that were affected just happened to be some of the most popular trees to plant near lawns and on golf courses?
Yeah, of course, there's a couple things going on there. These are also, some of the faster-growing trees. So when people, in a lot of situations I've seen, would be someone has a screen between their backyard and the neighbors, well, of course, you're going to plant something like, eastern white pine or a Norway spruce that's going to be a fast-growing tree to give you that buffer. And then, of course, the turf goes right up near the edge of that. And so that's kind of the scenario that, at least in the site visits I've made, is kind of one of the more common scenarios.
And what's your estimation right now of the percentage of injury on a basic tree? I mean, most of the photographs I've seen with the extension articles has, of course, been the most dramatic ones, trees that just look like almost like they were in a fire. But I also read reports of trees who appeared to be dead or were totally brown on one side, and in another report that the damage spiraled around the tree.
Yeah, you'll see that lots of variation in the pattern of injury. You'll see cases too where you have two very similar looking trees side by side, one with heavy damage, one that appears almost totally unaffected. So we're getting all kinds of these patterns because, this, if it's in process, this could be a root uptake issue. And so you will see this many trees, especially conifers, have what we call a spiral ascent pattern. So as the water and nutrients are moving up through the trunk of the tree, they actually spiral around as they go up. And so that's reflected then sometimes in how this damage may manifest itself. In the same token, you can have trees where maybe part of the backside of the tree is facing a road or a bed or something that doesn't get treated, and then on the turf side of the tree, then you can see some damage. So you see all these kind of of scenarios and things that sort of make you scratch your head. In terms of the extent of damage, it varies the whole range. We've seen some trees that have only light amounts of damage, maybe just at the very tips of the top of the tree. Others where maybe there's just some foliar discoloration too. Of course, as you described, where the whole tree is all the new growth is turned brown.
And those trees, I guess what we're going to have to do to some degree is wait and hope. Again, a fast-growing tree, despite its problems, is also the tree that has the most potential to outgrow an attack like this. So when do you think we'll know, are they really most sincerely dead?
Well, that's really a good question. We don't have a lot of experience with this product. Obviously, there was testing done by universities and by DuPont. I'm sure some of that information will come to light, and maybe there's been some cases where they had some damage and were able to see trees recover. So, based on past experience with other types of environmental injury and other types of herbicides, certainly by next spring you should be able to tell if some of these things are going to recover or not. The big thing, and a lot of these, is we see cases where a third or half of the tree is brown. Well, that tree's probably going to recover in the long term, but it's a matter of how much effort are you going to have to expend to maybe do some corrective pruning. We like conifers, pines, and spruces because we like the nice pyramidal shape and all of this. But if you have many of these terminal shoots killed near the top, then you're going to be inclined to get lots of multiple leaders and things that we probably have to take some professional care. Someone to come in and actually prune those to keep it as a single leader and restore some of that symmetry and the form that we like. So it's really kind of a long term deal, and it's really going to be on a case by case basis. I've talked to some people. It really depends on the situation where the tree is planted. If you have something that is forming a buffer between you and the neighbor, it has a few brown shoots. Well, maybe you're willing to live with that and let the tree grow through it. Other people, this is a specimen tree in the middle of your yard. You want that thing replaced, and you want to move on to something else. So it's really going to be a case by case kind of scenario as far as what's an acceptable tree and what's not.
And you and I know to take down a mature tree safely and professionally that's near homes is a super expensive proposition. And then you're always the poor people who do arborvitae. I mean, my feeling is the fifth one always dies. So, they wanted this picket fence look, and instead they got, it looks like a tooth got knocked out.
Yeah. As you get into larger and larger trees, it gets progressively more expensive and more difficult to replace a tree of that size. I mean, it definitely is a very complicated issue, no doubt.
Michigan, you're ground zero for some of the damage, right? There was a quote in the Times article from a Michigan landscaper who said, he's up to 350 trees that appear to be dead from lawns he treated.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about ground zero. Certainly we're affected, but we've seen reports from Indiana and Kansas and Pennsylvania, so it's a pretty broad swath here, basically the upper Midwest and into the Northeast. It seems to be showing the most reports so far.
But we know that if you have a lawn care service or, a professional treats your lawn and you have any of these affected conifers in distress, you should get in touch with your local EPA. You should get in touch with the landscaper. They certainly know about this. And the advice I've seen online for trees that are showing a small amount of damage, I was actually reassured because it's what I tell people, and that's just flush the soil with as much water as you can get around the root system of the tree. Do you agree, sir?
Yeah, I'd say in general, especially right now, of course, we're sitting here today and it's, 95 degrees here in Michigan. So you want to, really try to minimize any additional stress on the tree, and so that means keeping some water to them. I'd be a little careful that you don't waterlog the tree. That you can potentially, especially if you don't have very well drained soil, you do have the potential to cause some stress that way. So probably every couple of days, I would say, if you want to set the sprinkler by it, give it a half hour, good long soak. That would probably be the ideal thing, and kind of let it dry a bit in between, and then re-wet is kind of the scenario you want to go for there, because if you have this thing, you know, sort of sitting in water, you leave a soaker hose on it overnight, that kind of thing, you can also, you know, maybe compound some problems that way too.
Right. Let's say that you should never do that if you have clay soil, but if you have sandy soil, for once, that might be on your side.
Yep. That's true.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. We'll be following this story. We wanted to let our listeners know that this was happening around the country, except for California and New York, who never allowed Imprellis to be registered there. I think they're going to get to take a prize from the top shelf after all this is over. We've been speaking with Dr. Bert Craig, an associate professor of horticulture and forestry and an extension specialist with Michigan State University. He joined us from his office at Michigan State. Dr. Craig, thank you so much for your time, and please keep us posted on the developments in this very serious issue.
Okay, will do. Thanks, Mike.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty good today. David, how are you, sir?
I'm doing real good.
And where is David doing real good?
Bristol, Tennessee.
Damn.
Birthplace of country music.
What can we do for David in Bristol?
Well, a friend of mine has a tomato problem. She's 73 years old, and we worked in the garden together for quite a few years. And we never could get the tomatoes to really ripen up on the vine.
Really?
One year they while they were still green, they rotted on the vine and fell off to the ground.
Okay.
She finally asked me to help her take the garden apart. We covered it with grass seed and grew grass on it.
Gotcha.
And she started growing her tomatoes in these big plastic pots. Probably 2 or 3 quarts, maybe, or bigger.
2-3 quarts is not even close. I would imagine that the pots that I use that I grow a single tomato plant in probably hold about, they're a little bit bigger than a 5-gallon bottle of water. I would probably say my minimum would be about 7 gallons of soil-free mix and compost for a nice-sized tomato plant. The size containers you're talking about would be good for peppers or a cucumber or eggplant, but tomatoes need a very large space. When I tell people a container for tomato, I typically describe it, because I went home and measured these once, as a 17-inch pot. That's a pot that's 17 inches across the top and about 17 inches high. And they're pretty big, and you can plant little herbs around the outside and everything, but tomatoes need a lot of room to grow. Now, what is she filling the containers with?
She uses a potting soil.
Okay, that's good. And anything else?
I'm sure she uses Miracle-Gro, the tomato Miracle-Gro.
Well, it's obviously not causing any miracles here. The containers are much too small. I'm surprised that she didn't do well in the ground. I'll tell you what, is she going to grow in containers from now on?
I believe so.
Let's get big containers. You know, we want something that looks like a professional version of a 5-gallon bucket. At least that tall, but wider at the top, a real container of some sort. It doesn't have to be a plant pot, but don't use buckets. You need something that is going to be nice and stable. Don't put any junk in the bottom. Don't put any pebbles or peanuts or broken pots. Top to bottom, 3/4 soil-free mix, 1/4 compost. This winter, tell her to save up her eggshells. You save up your eggshells. When you get the tomato plants, fill your containers with the combination of soil-free mix and compost. Plant them deeply. That means at least half of the tomato plant stem under the soil line. And then, before you fill it in, take about a dozen crushed dried eggshells and put those right over top of the root ball. And then fill it in and then put up your support, because you're going to get a big honking tomato plant out of this, and you want to support it well. Is she getting morning sun and 6 to 8 hour sun a day?
Yeah, because she's got them on her back deck, and they get a lot of sun.
How does she water?
She waters every day.
Death on a stick.
Death on a stick.
Yeah. When you do CSI, you'll probably see the roots are rotten. We don't know anything about the drainage, but that's essentially it. Tomatoes require the biggest container of any of the summer crops we grow. Containers are much better, like I said, for peppers or cucumbers or eggplant or something like that. Next year, invest in a good amount of soil-free mix. You can get it in big bales like peat moss. Some good high-quality compost. Make sure there's good drainage. Big containers next year will be the charm. It sounds like one of the problems this year is overwatering and just way too small a container. As you get ready to do this, go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z. There's a complete article on growing tomatoes in containers that'll hold your hand.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care, sir.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and assure everybody who's fretting over suddenly barren plants that it's perfectly normal for tomatoes to stop producing during a heat wave. Tomato pollen simply fries to a crisp when the temps soar into the mid-90s. It shouldn't affect any fruits that have already set, and new fruits should appear when the heat finally breaks. But don't you go breathing a sigh of love apple relief just yet, because we'll be right back with what to do when daughter comes a-calling and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Rutgers Earth Center will host their annual Garden Field Day and open house on Saturday, August 20th from 1 to 5 at the Earth Center in Davidson's Mill Pond Park in South Brunswick, New Jersey. The Trevose Horticultural Society invites the public to attend their annual flower show on Friday, August 26th and Saturday, August 27th at the Wood River Village Auditorium in Bensalem, PA. Admission to both events is free. And Phil Abundance is accepting donations of fresh garden produce to help feed the area's hungry. You can drop your extras off Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon at any of 11 different area locations. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
WHYY welcomes listeners in South Jersey, including WNJM at 89.9 Manahawkin, WNJN 89.7 Atlantic City, and WNJZ 90.3 Cape May. The WHYY forecast, a chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon and a high around 87 degrees. Tonight, more rain likely with a low near 73. It's 82 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia at 11:39. This is WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll talk about a weird plant that I hope all of you never get to see in person, the rootless parasitic weed known as dodder. But I want to tell you about it because I want you all to be prepared. If it looks like Spider-Man had a battle in your backyard, you need to know what to do. And that information is coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good. Dave, how are you, sir?
I couldn't be better.
Good. And where could you not be better?
Glenside, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Dave in Glenside?
I guess like the beginning to the middle of June, I planted sunflower seeds, which I've never planted before. Gardening's all a pretty much a new thing to me.
Right.
And I've been told that there's different varieties of sunflowers, and I believe that the type that I planted are called mammoth sunflowers.
Oh, man.
And the reason why I'm saying that is because they're like 12 or 13 feet tall at this point.
Yes, these are Russian oil sunflowers. These are gigantic plants that are grown as a cash crop like corn or wheat for their oil-filled seeds that are used as bird seed, used to press sunflower oil. You know, people eat the seeds directly. They're a favorite food of wildlife. And these are gigundous plants. They a lot of times they can't even support themselves.
Right, I guess is what my question is. When they were growing, they were outstanding. And when they started to flower, they were gorgeous. And now all the heads are completely drooping over, facing the ground.
It's because there's a couple of 100 pounds of seeds in that puppy.
Yeah.
If you start to get birds and squirrels noticing this largesse, you're supposed to actually put a burlap sack over the head.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's what happens to them. I mean, if you go around and you see people who've grown mammoth sunflowers, full-size sunflowers, Russian sunflowers, whatever you want to call them, at this time of the year, we're approaching harvest time. That's what the heads do. They droop down.
Okay.
So you want to start checking the heads for the doneness of the sunflower. Do you have a plan here for your harvest, or is the success just a total shock to you?
No, I don't have a plan for them. I mean, I feed birds all the time. I was assuming I would just feed the birds and the wildlife. This may be a silly question, but once I cut those heads off, do they only get one bloom a year?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, and winter's coming.
Right,
yeah.
So after I cut the head off, then it's okay to just cut the plants down altogether?
Yeah, they make great compost fodder because of their biomass, and if you want to do it again next year, you can plant any time in your area after May 15th.
Okay.
And there's also very compact, smaller, much more brightly colored and upright varieties that are known as ornamental sunflowers.
Okay.
And those won't fall over. They still develop seeds that wildlife can use, but they're in a riot of colors. Some of them are only a foot or 2 feet tall.
Okay.
But these are a classic cash crop that you've grown.
Right, right.
All right, well, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Dave. Good luck.
Have a nice day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking my call, bub.
Well, thank you for making it, Dan. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Northeast Philly.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Dan in the great Northeast?
Well, Mike, I have a large oak tree in my backyard, and obviously it's Death Valley under it, so I'd like to make a raised bed garden, and I'm afraid of girdling the tree with what I intend to use for soil. That would be lawn waste compost and regular Pennsylvania dirt mixed together. If I go 8 inches up the trunk, most of the bark is still there around the base of the tree, but there is some missing. About a 6x6 piece is missing for some reason. And the B part of my question is, squirrels jump out of this giant oak tree into my peach tree and eat the peaches.
Yeah, what a shock. They are evil servants of Satan, sent to earth to bedevil gardeners to make sure we don't have too good of a time. The question, now, I want to go back to your bogus idea. Why in the name of God do you want to build something underneath an oak tree?
Well, because it's wasteland, and the rest of my property is heavily gardened and looks great, and then in the middle of it, you have this eyesore.
Why is it an eyesore, Dan?
Well, because the tree's got to be 75 years old, and the roots are quite formidable, and you can't really plant anything there. I had a couple of sedum plants there, and they actually got thrown up out of the ground last winter.
Dan, you say you have an extensively planted landscape. You appear to have a perfect specimen of a mighty old oak tree showing its musculature with its root flare raised above the ground dramatically as it was intended to be in nature, and you're going to try to improve this?
Only aesthetically. Not horticulturally.
I think the aesthetics is in your brain synapses, Dan.
Okay.
This is the way trees are supposed to look. Now, if you wish to define the tree and frame it and show it off a little bit, What do we have growing once we get outside the drip line in the root zone of the tree?
There are a bunch of foundation plants along my border fence, roses, canna lilies, dahlias.
Then what I think you should do, you mentioned you were going to have yard waste compost.
That's correct.
I think you should take the yard waste compost and, starting about 6 inches out from the trunk of the tree, spread it out about an inch thick, make a nice big defined black circle that sets it off, and end the circle where the new plantings begin. Don't try to plant anything in that circle. Allow the base of the tree to be natural as it was meant to be. As to the squirrels, man, they are a full-time enterprise. You know, the people have set up sort of electrical systems in between the two trees, like, you know, some hanging electrical net. How much room is there between the edges of the two trees?
It's about a leap of 15 feet that they love to make.
How about if you go out and buy some of this invisible deer fencing? It's like 8 feet tall, stakes in the ground. It's made of a green mesh so that you don't see it from most angles.
Okay.
And literally put up an invisible fence between the two structures so that at the very least the squirrels now have to get out of the oak tree and crawl up into the peach tree.
I should advise, my peach tree is 5 years old now, so it's up there. It's up there about 16 foot.
Well, how are you caring for it?
Well, when I first did the initial trimming, you know, to get it into that cup-like shape,
yeah,
I haven't done very much ever since.
You're supposed to prune that tree every winter to keep it within reach. Now you can't thin the peaches at the top of the tree. You can't handle disease at the top of the tree. All bad things are going to start at the top of the tree where you can't reach, and they're going to infect the peaches that are down below. This winter, you're going to have to start a radical three-year pruning program to get that thing back down over the course of 3 years to around 10 feet high. Unless you're going to get a cherry picker or some sort of fancy orchard ladder.
I do have a real nice ladder. That's what I relied on last year, but I didn't really need it because of the darn squirrels.
Well, you know, you are wasting your energy on the wrong parts of your yard. As you know, peach trees need a lot of care. They need yearly pruning. They need thinning of the fruits. And yes, everything on the planet likes to eat peaches. If you don't want to do the netting, which I think might help you out, there's a product called Surround. At least that's what Gardens Alive sells it as, and I think other people sell it. I don't think it's proprietary, but it's a micronized clay spray. And it's sold for the prevention of disease and insect infestation on fruit trees. It coats the trees with a thin film of clay. But that might confuse the heck out of the squirrels. Otherwise, you know, it's a tough problem. You can't spray repellents on fruit that you're hoping to eat. If you put a motion-activated sprinkler pointing up at the tree, you're going to keep the leaves wet. It's going to get diseased. So I would think a combination of an invisible netting blocking the squirrels, spray the tree with Surround, give that an experiment, because so far, you know, your peaches are still developing. I hope you're thinning them aggressively.
Yeah, it brought a tear to my eye, but nevertheless, I did it.
Yeah, and then over the next 3 years, you got to bring this thing down in size, seriously, or everything bad that happens at the top of the tree will destroy your peaches no matter what you do.
I see. That I was unaware, although I am a happy Gardens Alive customer.
Okay, good, good. Well, get happier.
Yeah.
All right, Dan.
Thanks. I appreciate your sesquipedalian scintillations, Mike.
All right. You take care, pal.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Dodder, the parasitic silly string weed. Our question comes from Sylvia, who lives near Wilmington, Delaware. She writes, there's a weird thread-like thing creeping over and growing into the stems of our English ivy ground cover that we have identified as a parasitic plant known as dodder or hellbine. It looks as if somebody threw a yellow fishing net over our ivy, and the, quote, net grows back very fast anytime it's removed. An extension bulletin from the University of Florida seems to say that all we can do is cut the ivy off close to the ground and hope that the ivy grows back, but not the dodder. Do you know anything better? And I haven't found any reference to its existence this far north. Should I be reporting this to somebody? It would wreak havoc with a cash crop. Well, your parasitic plant has many names, Sylvia. Most commonly known as dodder, it's also called devil's hair, strangleweed, and bellbind. Native Americans who lived on reservations around the time of World War II called it the devil's shoelace and used burlap sacks filled with the crushed plants to stun fish for easy capture. But my favorite alias is love vine. Young women in the South were told to break off a piece of the vine, call out the name of a young man they were interested in, throw the vine onto another plant, and if it grew there, the affection was mutual. But that's about the only affection involved with this pest. Dodder is a true parasite. It lacks the ability to make its own chlorophyll, so it attaches itself to other plants to steal theirs. Now, it begins life pretty normally, as a seed that germinates in the soil. The brightly neon-colored stem that emerges will die quickly if it can't reach another plant. But if it does find a victim, it attaches itself to the poor plant, breaks away from its original root system in the soil, and digs into the host with tiny root-like structures called haustoria. Then it flourishes as it sucks moisture and nutrients from the host. Although I've never seen it in person, it has been observed just about everywhere, it seems. We ran a photo of it back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine in the 90s, and over 400 readers wrote in to say that they had seen or battled dodder. We got reports from Quebec, upstate New York, Missouri, Alabama, North Carolina, Hawaii, and Guam, where it was, and probably still is, a very serious pest of farms and gardens. An extension agent from Cornell wrote to explain that there are three different species of the plant in the U.S. alone. Now, getting rid of your dodder by cutting the ivy back is unfortunately probably a little too optimistic at this point. Once a plant is infected with this vampire vine, you need to destroy the vine and the host plant immediately, before the dodder can produce its tiny white, pink, or yellow flowers. Those flowers quickly produce seed pods, typically from late spring through early summer, and if those seeds are allowed to develop and drop to the ground, you're in deep doo-doo, because then more dodder's going to sprout up right alongside any surviving ivy. The seeds are not bothered by winter weather and remain viable for many, many decades. No matter what the timing, that existing ivy, like any plant dodder digs into, is a lost cause. As you quickly learned, pulling the vine off an affected plant doesn't help, as every little bit of that haustoria that remains in the parasitized plant tissue will resprout. Again, when dodder appears, the best answer is to act quickly and remove and destroy the infected plant. If you're certain it didn't flower and set seed, you can replant right away. But the time of year you emailed us, mid-July, means that the seeds have probably already formed and dropped. My advice is to carefully mow the ivy down as low as you can get it. Don't spread the infected plants around with a weed whacker or anything, or the dodder will dig into other hosts. Collect every last piece of ivy and dispose of it in the trash. Then get a propane-powered flame weeder and torch the soil several times on hot and dry days to try and destroy the seeds. Don't till the soil to remove the plants or to ready the ground for replanting. You'd be sure to plant lots of dodder seed. Then the next move is up to you. I would personally install some sacrificial plants, water them well, and wait to see if they get doddered before I replace the ivy. If you feel sure you waged enough war against this wicked weed, you can try planting new ivy this fall, but I really don't recommend it. I know, this advice is extreme in the extreme, but you really have no other good options. chemical herbicides would kill the ivy as well as the dodder, and they might not be as deadly to the dodder, and you'd still have those seeds to deal with. And listeners, let this be a warning to all of yous. Dodder can show up anywhere at any time, and you must be prepared to act quickly and decisively. If one of your plants suddenly appears to have been attacked by Spider-Man, carefully remove it and trash it. If you get to it before the flowers have appeared, you simply lose a plant. But when dodder is allowed to flower and set seed, you lose the season, and perhaps several seasons to come. Well, that sure was an interesting discussion on how to handle dang dodder now, wasn't it? Luckily for yous, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it in detail, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to dodder me if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live in the email. Put the actual subject of your email in the subject line of the email. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters are Richard the Barbarian Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our silly but not stringy intern is Jessica Mandick. Parasite-free Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, just said he thought Historia was the name of a hotel. I'm your host, doddering Mike McGrath, and I'll refill my web shooters so I can inflict myself upon you again next week. The right time is almost here for the successful sowing of cool season grass seed. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll walk you through a perfect plan for your new lawn, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Wilmington University.